And, you know, there's a great danger that if you do marginalise groups like ourselves, like Stop Stands to the Expansion, so that we don't have an opportunity at public inquiry to argue our case in a civilised way, get rid of us, and the alternative might be much less civilised and much less pleasant. It beggars belief that in the 21st century we should be turning the clock back so far as democracy and public involvement is concerned.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me,
let's not fly to Llama Land right now. I know there's a one-man band there who will toot his flute for us, Frank, but let's do a reality check. It's 2007, and the science on climate change has never been more robust, the warnings from experts have never been stronger, and the signs of change have never been clearer for people to see. Last year, the Tyndall Centre produced a report saying, "If there's one important message we want to reiterate, it is the absolute urgency with which we must act to curb dramatically our carbon dioxide emissions. In waiting for technology or the EU emissions trading scheme to offer a smooth transition to a low carbon future, we are deluding ourselves. It is an act either of negligence or irresponsibility for policymakers to continually to refer to a 2050 target as the key driver for addressing climate change. The real challenge we face is making the radical shift onto a low-carbon pathway by 2010 to 2012, and thereby driving down carbon intensity at an unprecedented 9% per annum for up to two decades." To put the Tyndall Centre's analysis another way, we have 3 to 5 years to put in place the necessary infrastructure to enable a swift change in the direction of our society's carbon intensity. Just 3 to 5 years. So has the government responded by marshalling all its resources to achieve this and made climate change its number one priority? Do we, as the Tyndall Centre suggested, have a Secretary of State for Climate Change sitting in the Cabinet, ensuring that all government departments are helping make the transition towards a low-carbon society? On the contrary, the government has done precious little of substance other than reinforcing business as usual. In the area of transport, for example, the government is on course to provide for a tripling of aviation movements and for a road development programme which will cost some £13 billion. With so little time to spare, such high stakes, and so little evidence of political will, is it time to draw the conclusion that the government is institutionally incapable of moving us in the direction of a low-carbon society within the necessary time frame? This week, in an aviation planning disaster special, Climate Radio catches up with campaigners who are operating at the coalface of our democratic means for influencing the planning system in the direction of a low-carbon future. And later on in the programme, we'll be hearing from Friends of the Earth and the Planning Disaster Coalition about how the government is intent on eroding even these democratic means. First, I spoke to Brian Ross from Stop Stansted Expansion, and asked him about the government's argument that aviation is so important to the UK economy that it must be allowed to grow, forcing even deeper emissions cuts in all other sectors. Did they have a case?
So far as the economics are concerned, Stansted Airport is first and foremost a leisure airport. They want an extra 10 million passengers. Only 300,000 would be business passengers. The great majority of Stansted passengers are people flying out with Ryanair or EasyJet, British people, flying off to spend their money in leisure breaks, stag nights, short breaks on the continent. And how on earth that benefits the British economy to ship our people out on penny flights to spend their money in other countries. It makes no sense at all from an economic standpoint or from an environmental standpoint.
Mm. So you sent me a copy of your evidence to the Stop Stansted inquiry, and there's some figures in there about the deficit from tourism to the UK each year, and it's quite a staggering amount. Can you fill us in on what that is?
Well, last year it was £19 billion deficit on our balance of payments, arising from, that's the expenditure by British tourists overseas compared to the expenditure by foreign visitors coming to the UK. £19 billion. If you go back about 10 years, the numbers were just about in balance, actually. In fact, if you go back earlier than that, Britain used to have a net surplus. We used to earn money from foreign tourists. We earned more money than British people spent overseas. But since the rise in low-cost flights, that position has just dramatically changed. And that £19 billion, I think it was about 40 or 43% of our total trade balance last year. It's staggering, frankly, that the government should be so supportive of airport expansion. And within government, the Department for Transport has always been, well, we would say, a bit of a rogue department, in the sense that, well, it does have the formal objective of trying to support the UK aviation industry. But it really seems to have lost its sense of balance, or at the very least hasn't caught up with the realisation over the past few years that climate change is an urgent problem. It's got to be addressed now. The issue is far more serious than was believed even 2 or 3 years ago. This policy for expanding airports goes back to 2003, and they had another look at it last December, but they show no inclination to change their mind. They want a new runway at Stansted, new runway at Heathrow. They want, I think it's 4 or 5 new runways across the country, plus very substantial expansion of existing airports on top of that, without actually having to build runways. You can get quite big expansion through terminals and more intensive use of existing runways.
Mm. I mean, they did this, as you say, they did this review at the end of last year of their air transport white paper and how they've been getting on, and to see if their assumptions were right, and they said basically they were, and they were just going to continue to expand, like you say. But, I mean, the economic arguments that they're drawing on for those papers, aren't they all kind of paid for by the aviation authority? Or the aviation industry, I should say?
Well, three times the aviation industry has gone to external consultants to get some economic evidence to support their case. On each occasion, they've gone to the same consultancy. And on each occasion, of course, the consultancy tells them what they want to hear, that aviation makes this huge contribution to the UK economy. All of their analysis, in terms of its importance to business, is based on the results of a questionnaire survey. They sent out 6,000 questionnaires. They got 165 replies. 97.5% of the companies they sent it to didn't even think it was important enough to reply. And on the basis of those 165 replies, they make some sweeping statements about how important aviation is. And the Department for Transport has taken that report, hook, line and sinker, and uses the numbers in that report as if they were gospel. We're told that we must use sound science. And when we submit evidence, if it's not robust and well-researched and evidenced, then our evidence is criticised. And yet the industry can pull figures out of the air, and the Department for Transport publishes them as if they were facts.
And the other thing that's stood out from this critique was that the government is actually picking selectively, almost, from the aviation-funded research, so they're actually putting further bias on an already biased report. For example, when they're talking about the amount of money that comes into the country from tourism, they omit to mention the amount of money that goes out, that we spend abroad on tourism, which, as you pointed out, is a good deal more.
Indeed, but, you know, we've long passed the stage of being surprised by the Department for Transport. They're almost the political wing of the aviation industry. And, you know, for years we used to watch with open-jawed amazement when the Department for Transport accepted the aviation industry arguments and just swept the environmental arguments under the carpet. But it's just par for the course.
Going back to the government's review of its progress with the white paper, whereas they drew heavily on the Oxford forecasting they completely ignored an Oxford University Environmental Change Institute report, which is a lot more credible. And they actually bring into question all of the assumptions that the government makes about the economic impacts of aviation. A quote here from the summary, it says that it cannot be assumed that restricting future growth in air travel will necessarily be economically detrimental. And yet, the government completely ignores this advice.
Well,
or evidence.
You say the government. I mean, principally, it's the Department for Transport which is driving this. But the House of Commons Environmental Audit Committee, an all-party scrutiny committee, looked at the Air Transport White Paper. And the report is interesting reading. They speak about being astonished at the level of bias. They find it incredible that the Department for Transport chooses to completely disregard the trade deficit arising from the rapid growth in low-cost flights. They were scathing about the report. They pointed out that the Department for Transport even broke the Treasury rules when trying to calculate the economic benefits. But so far we haven't really been called to boot.
That was Brian Ross, economics advisor to Stop Stansted Expansion. We first interviewed a representative of Stop Stansted Expansion about their campaign back in 2005. So we asked Brian Ross to give an update on how things were going 2 years down the line. They are currently in the middle of a public inquiry, facing down the British Aviation Authority, BAA, and recently they called in expert testimony from an Inuit leader about the impact climate change is already having on his community.
And the difficulty with the inquiry process is that at the end of the day, two secretaries of state make the decision.
Mm.
One of them is Ruth Kelly.
Right. I mean, I understand that the District Council rejected Stansted Expansion on environmental grounds.
Yeah.
And the regional
unanimously.
And the Regional Assembly is also opposing the expansion, is that right?
Well, the Regional Assembly opposes a second runway.
Okay.
The Regional Assembly was actually prepared to accept that the existing runway could be used to its maximum capacity.
Okay.
And that's the argument we're fighting just now at this inquiry.
Okay.
But so far as a second runway is concerned, and the application for that will come pretty soon.
Okay.
So far as a second runway is concerned, the Regional Assembly was totally opposed to it. All local politicians, all local MPs, MEPs, councillors, county councillors, district councillors, totally unanimously against it, or from all parties. But the government has forced the Regional Assembly to alter its policy. In fact, the government has redrafted it effectively and said your policy must be consistent with national policy, so the regional plan must support a second runway and stands there.
Right.
And now, of course, whether for that reason or whether for a range of reasons, I think regional assemblies haven't willingly towed the line. The government intends to abolish the East of England Regional Assembly, and I think almost all of the others as well.
Mm.
So, you know, strike a blow for democracy. Go and live in North Korea.
Right. Well, it's not good news. And then there's the planning white paper, of course, as well. which further strengthens the hand of central government to impose aviation expansion and road building.
Again, the government seems to take the view that local democracy gets in the way of things, then marginalise local democracy and marginalise people like ourselves, campaign groups who try to present sensible arguments. And, you know, there's a great danger that if you do marginalise groups like ourselves, like Stop Stanton Expansion, so that we don't have an opportunity at public inquiry to argue our case in a civilised way, that the alternative to having organisations like ourselves, they're non-political, we've got 6,500 members, we've got almost all the local district councils and parish councils as members, voluntary organisation, go about things in a sensible and civilised way. Get rid of us, and the alternative might be much less civilised and much less pleasant, because if people feel that they don't have the opportunity to make their argument in a sensible way, then they might make their argument, or some people might make their argument in a less sensible way. And that, I don't think that's really the kind of society we want to have. There's another point, actually, which I think is just sad and foolish about this. The one thing we've learned over the last several months at this public inquiry is that we're able to put the developer in the dock, so to speak, where they've got to explain their arguments with evidence and be subject to cross-examination and provide all the facts and be truthful and give the details and the analysis behind it, and be transparent. Now, that's the first time in 25 years that we've been able to question BAA and try to get proper facts from them. Over the past 25 years, up until this public inquiry, they could just rely upon spin and secrecy and local media and PR, and you'd never get to the facts. You could never get the facts. And it's a breath of fresh air and hugely informative for everybody to have a process, a public inquiry process, where you can drill down, explore the facts, expose the real information. It's a breath of fresh air, and the government wants to abolish that. It just beggars belief. It beggars belief that in the 21st century we should be turning the clock back so far as democracy and public involvement is concerned.
Brian Ross. To find out more about that threat to democracy, I spoke to Paul De Silva of Friends of the Earth, one of the many civil society groups to oppose the planning white paper, in a huge coalition called Planning Disaster.
So the planning system is important because the decisions made there can determine whether or not we meet our climate change targets and whether or not we kind of lock ourselves into a high carbon or a low carbon future.
Planning systems are absolutely central. And absolutely. You know, we need to use the planning system to start driving the kind of development that we think are the solutions to climate change, the low energy developments, the kind of transport systems that will allow people to travel without causing so much energy waste. And to start saying no to the kind of development that we're getting all too much of at the moment, which is, as you say, locking in unsustainable trends and certainly very high energy and climate trends for the next 10, 15 or longer years.
So Friends of the Earth, along with the World Wildlife Fund and the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England, commissioned a study to look at how well the nine regions in England were doing in terms of delivering environmental sustainability.
Yeah.
What were your overall findings?
Well, we did a study called How Green Is Your Region? And what we found was that while there was some good effort by individual regional assemblies to try to really grab hold of the whole environmental challenge on things like transport, wildlife, energy standards in buildings, climate change policies. Ultimately, it didn't matter how good individual policies were. They were still essentially undermined by those regional assemblies and those regional strategies having to comply with centrally dictated, what I would call, unsustainable trends.
So the government emphasis on economic growth and their policies of aviation expansion and road expansion are actually stifling regions' ability to deliver environmental sustainability and well-being.
Yeah, in a nutshell, we have this conflict, and it doesn't have to be a conflict, between trying to put in place the policies we need for the future to safeguard everyone's future and to stabilise our climate, being undermined by policies which are incredibly short-term, which are said to be justified because apparently they're going to be good for our economy. Yet there's a lot of very conflicting evidence as to whether more road building, more airport expansion and flights is actually good for the UK economy. There is this unfortunate pitching against each other by central government of environmental objectives versus what are generally seen as being economic objectives. But this is a debate that's been playing out for a few years now. And I think our study just brings it home that it's actually affecting the way decisions happen at the local level.
Right. Now, things are moving on apace, aren't they? Because we've had the planning white paper in the fairly recent past, which probably came out around the same time as your report, yeah?
Yes, a bit earlier. Yes,
okay.
Just a few months before, yeah.
Now, you had a clear recommendation in your report that the planning white paper should actually be, if we're actually going to deliver environmental sustainability in this country, we need a clear framework of policy priorities with climate change at the top and the ability of the regions to deviate from national policy where necessary in order to ensure environmental sustainability and well-being. But what does the planning white paper actually propose? It's going in a different direction, I understand.
Yeah, well, the planning white paper is a real worry because essentially it's dressing up with lots of language of community involvement and consultation and participation and protecting people's rights, but ultimately it is removing people's rights to have a say over the kind of developments that will most make a big difference on their local area or even their wider region. And the planning white paper is proposing yet another set of reforms to the planning system, even before the last set of reforms from a few years ago have even really bedded down, to make it easier to essentially fast-track decisions over what we call major infrastructure projects, the big type of developments that tend to get the headlines, things from large airports, big runways, big motorways, large energy plants, things like that. Even large renewable energy plants like wind farms. Certainly Friends of the Earth's view is that the planning system seems to be constantly talked about in central government as being a block on any form of economic development, and there really isn't any evidence for that. When this claim was made a few years ago, even committees of the House of Commons and the House of Lords found it really hard to find any of the claims made by ministers or by the Confederation of British Industry and others that the planning system was somehow stopping the UK from being a successful economy. But that claim still seems to have currency, and it is essentially being used to speed up the planning system to make it easier for developers to get what they want and to have minimal public scrutiny of their plans. So the planning system is already pretty difficult for the public to engage with, and I think the danger with the planning white paper and the consultation on that closes on the 17th of August, the danger is that the public will be further shut out from the system and decisions will essentially be made centrally. And when you suddenly realise you might have a development in your area that you might not be particularly keen on or you'd like to have your voice heard about, the options for having that choice, that hearing, will be extremely curtailed. And our real concern is, I suppose, twofold. One is we don't think people's rights should be removed, but we certainly shouldn't be removed also to create easier pathways for the kind of climate-damaging developments which I think this is all going to lead to.
Mm. And it's not just Friends of the Earth that are saying this, is it? I mean, there's a new coalition that's come together. I think some people have described it as unprecedented, the amount of organisations that have come together, which have a combined membership of 6 million people, come together in this planning disaster coalition. So they're all pretty much saying the same thing, yeah?
Yeah, the planningdisaster.co.uk website allows people to respond to the consultation and to understand what's really involved in all of this. And you can certainly also look at the map that we produced into where the major infrastructure projects might go that are currently, the government has talked about being the kind of developments that they really want to fast track and have least public involvement in scrutinising. So the government's view here is that the public just get in the way and that they should be allowed to speak but not actually make any difference to ultimately what is decided. This is a very serious attack on people's rights and democracy. And I think I'm very concerned about what this might mean, not just for planning, but for democracy in general. I think the government is very much on course to try and do this, and ultimately it will regret it because people will realise that their voice has been stifled, and they will start to wonder what local democracy is about, let alone the way in which central government works. So I think the government's got a particular problem on its hands with this development because it's also getting rid of regional assemblies at an England
yeah,
level as well.
That was the final thing that that I was hoping to address with you, because this is something that George Monbiot pointed out recently in The Guardian, the announcement by the Treasury in July that it's going to be shutting the regional assemblies and just having the regional development authorities instead, which Monbiot says are largely business-led. So that actually is going to remove this formal opportunity that NGOs have had to make their case and influence planning policy. Do you share that assessment?
Broadly, the government's decided it's going to phase out the 8 assemblies in England, outside London that is, and that any strategic thinking and any master plan is going to be now run by the regional economic development agencies, the RDAs as we call them, and the RDAs are essentially business-led, economically driven organisations. They have a duty to deliver sustainable development, but actually, we don't think that they've been fulfilling that purpose at all. They are starting to look a bit at the green agenda, but ultimately, they still are very much in the mould of saying we need more airports, we need more roads, we need more of this, that and the other. Anything that will boost the region's economy and create jobs or safeguard jobs.
So there you have it. Government policies on road building and aviation expansion mean that the regional planning system is unable to deliver environmental sustainability. To make things worse, the government is now proposing to fast-track unsustainable infrastructure projects and sideline the right of civil society to have a say in planning at local and regional levels. Furthermore, it has decided to hand over regional planning to business-led regional economic development agencies. So by way of conclusion, I'll repeat the question I posed at the beginning of the programme. With so little time to spare, such high stakes, and so little evidence of political will, is it time to draw the conclusion that the government is institutionally incapable of moving us in the direction of a low-carbon society within a sufficient time frame? Alan Simpson, MP, seems to think so. Here he is talking about his decision to step down as an MP earlier this year. This has been a Climate Radio Aviation Planning Disaster Special. Thanks for listening.
Alan, what's the reasoning behind your decision to stand down at this stage?
Well, I only ever went into Parliament for a very simple reason. I didn't want a career, I just wanted to change the world. And I suppose I'm leaving for precisely the same reason. I think we've probably got about 10 or 15 years maximum in order to do something quite profound if we're going to survive the really serious challenges of climate change. And all of the big changes that we need to make are very doable, but they require acts of courage that I don't think are going to be led from Parliament anymore. I think my decision when I looked at the parliamentary landscape was to say, are we going to be brave enough to lead the country into that change? And I think we're not. Most of our policies are strapped to the interests of the financial services sector, and global corporate business. And by and large, they're the ones who've got us into the mess that we're in.